Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to a beautiful, hot, muggy July day. Thank you for tuning in to the Sunday morning wake-up call. Good to be back. Thanks to Dan Gould and Sean McCord for taking care of things while I was gone. Happy first anniversary to my wife, Karen Moore, and the beautiful beaches of the OBX. Thanks to my guest today, Professor Philip Potter. How are you today, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here with me. It's a lovely day to be here. And Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics, Director of the National Security Policy Center. What's that all about?
It's a center that we have at UVA that's trying to essentially help policy be informed by academic research, right? So help us do a better job out there as policymakers.
Professor Potter specializing in foreign policy and international relations, also conducts research in the area of international terrorism, and is a principal investigator for a Department of Defense Minerva Initiative project to map and analyze collaborative relationships between terrorist organizations. His book, War and Democratic Constraint, now available. So I have to ask, because of all those things, quite overwhelming of work and importance, what is the Minerva Initiative Project and how did that get its name?
So the Minerva Initiative, we didn't give it the Minerva name. The Minerva name, as it kind of sounds, is a DOD thing. And what they do is they fund basic research in the social sciences on things that they care about, right? And again, this is part of this idea that they're going to bring in some good ideas from some folks in academia that might help with policy issues that they're worried about. In our case, that's about relationships between terrorist actors. So we know a fair amount about individual situations where pretty dangerous groups get involved with one another. So Hezbollah and Hamas cooperate. Things get worse in Israel. What we're doing is we're creating a global map of those relationships. So every relationship, 1965 to the present, over the entire globe, so that we have a better sense of where cooperation happens and what it means when it does.
So you work with, I have to say, Minerva Initiative sounds like it's named after someone's mother. It sounds like the person at the top of that said, oh, Mom, happy birthday. Look what I did. I named this project after you. Do you work with folks here at the NGIC? Can you announce that if you do?
So I think they were going more for the, you know, goddess of wisdom as opposed to their mother-in-law with the Minerva Initiative. But unfortunately, I think like a lot of Department of Defense things, the naming conventions go over everybody's head. We certainly have contact with folks at NGIC and other people within government. We like to help out in terms of, you know, speaker series and inviting to events and collaboration on those grounds. So certainly there is, you know, some contact and some friendly relationships.
All right. Again, our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics, also director of the National Security Policy Center, somewhat new.
Very new. Yeah, we officially got our sort of hunting license in June, so June 20th, and we're doing a July 20th big kickoff event in D.C. with some pretty interesting people. Bob Zelik, who was the former head of the World Bank, Michelle Florney, variety of other great panelists. So it should be an interesting event.
And we will be talking today about the President Trump's White House foreign policy. So stay with us for the hour. Certainly a lot, or some might say very little, to talk about during the hour. So I want to talk, I want to start with the USA standing in the free world, because it seems to me that with President Trump, the polls, and again, you hear what you hear depending on what channels you watch, depending on what articles, the blogs, the newspapers that you read. But the polls have the United States changing, dropping as leaders of the free world because of the current president and comments that he makes, decisions that he's making, and our foreign policy, the group that you hangs out with, the foreign policy talkers, the professors, those who are discussing these things and writing about foreign policy decisions, is this true? And are the decisions that his organization, his group, the people that he's chosen to make these decisions, are these decisions going to change our leadership in the free world, or have they done so already?
So I think they have, but I think there's sort of a couple things going on here as far as leadership is concerned that we should be keeping our eye on. The first of these is that, you know, in some sense, the entire Trump foreign policy is built around this idea of return to a type of leadership that we had immediately after World War II, right? So we controlled a majority of global GDP. The rest of the world was essentially in ashes. I tell my students, sort of constantly harp on this, but this notion that, you know, the 1950s, early 1960s were the anomaly rather than a period of time that we should consider normal. But in a lot of our policy discussion, a lot of our ideas about what sort of the proper role of the United States is in the world, people think about that period as a period of great American leadership. And it was, but there were aspects of that because of World War II that made it almost inevitable, right? Given that we were the intact industrial power in that period. So, you know, in some sense, this decline in unilateral leadership that we've seen after that is natural, right? As other people come back online, as other economies grow, and some of them are things that we did on purpose, right? So we rebuilt Europe in a way that it would be economically prosperous, right? It would be friendly but independent. Same thing in Japan. We've seen a separate emergence of China. So in some sense, there is this kind of natural decline in U.S. primacy that I think we need to be paying attention to here.
So it's not bad. This is not something that it's expected at some point in time, and whether it happens now or happens in 5 years or 10 years under a different administration, it's going to happen, and there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, and that kind of gets me to my second point, whether there's anything wrong with it, right? Which is, you know, there are different ways of handling this, okay? So what I'm getting at is there's sort of a deeper trend here where the U.S. has to deal with the fact that there, you know, globalization is going on, there are other powers at play here, but what we do about that in the short term and how we manage that matters a great deal. And this is where I think we're running into some problems with the Trump administration, and where some of these issues you're bringing up with regard to how we're viewed as a leader in the international system become really important, right? So we have data, as you alluded to, saying, hey, the U.S. is becoming a lot less popular, right? Certainly in Europe, parts of Asia, the Chinese were initially seemingly pretty excited about Trump at a popular level. That's cooled off considerably. And so there's this question of, as the U.S.'s sort of bigger economic trends converge on the rest of the globe, how do we manage that, right? And this is where I think people have a ton of concern about some of the Trump administration's pushes into isolationism, the skepticism about international institutions, trade protectionism. All of these things, in my view, are things that we built as institutions, frankly, to protect our place in the globe as the rest of the globe rebuilt, right? We controlled the rules of the game, right? We wrote, you know, everybody has to play Monopoly, but it turns out after World War II, the U.S. wrote the rules of Monopoly in a way that gave them some pretty good strategic advantages, right? And that's a little bit what I'm concerned with, is the management of this kind of deeper natural phenomenon that I'm talking about.
But if you write the rules for Monopoly, shouldn't you win Monopoly?
I think people underestimate the extent to which we're winning at Monopoly, right?
Even today?
Even today. We have some big problems in this country in terms of inequality, in terms of people not getting a good share of the pie, in terms of not feeling like their incomes are rising the same way that their parents did. We see issues demographically. We see issues in terms of rural-urban divides, where some parts of the country are doing better than others. But if you just sort of step back and look at how the U.S. has been doing as a country, as a unit, it's pretty good, right? Our economy has been growing. We're relatively healthy on that dimension. We're certainly strong, militarily speaking. And so the question then is, well, why don't people feel good about that? And I'd argue, actually, a lot of the problems about how people feel are domestic policy issues, right? They're not foreign policy issues. It's not that the rest of the world is eating our lunch. It's that we don't know how to divvy up our lunch.
Sunday morning wake-up call here on a beautiful Sunday morning. Our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, director of the National Security Policy Center. Starting this week, we're getting its...
We're laying the groundwork all summer, and we have our first students coming in the fall and a whole series of events. Certainly, I hope people keep an eye out for them.
As well as Professor Potter, UVA Department of Politics. Does the Make America Great Again hat from President Trump, you know, his big promotion while running for UVA, that's his... What's his way of leading the USA? Does that help the USA in terms of foreign policy?
No, I don't think so. I think there was an opening where, you know, maybe in different hands there could have been some advantages gained from that. There were some concerns in some circles that foreign policy under the Obama administration was perhaps not muscular enough, or at least not decisive enough, not rapid enough. I do think the Trump administration kind of put people back on their heels a little bit when they first came in, because there was this question of, well, what does this mean, right? What is the United States going to do in this context? And some of the top shelf things that the Trump administration people were complaining about were things that have been complained about kind of broadly across the American foreign policy spectrum. So, you know, to take one example, concern over NATO allies' payments, right? That's something that people have been complaining about for decades. The question is sort of, what do you do about that and how do you handle it? And I think that's where we started to have a lot of concerns, right? A sense that maybe this was not working out as well as we'd hoped. So, you know, as Make America Great Again has increasingly meant sort of withdrawing from a coherent leadership stance, you're already seeing, I think, other people rushing in to fill the void, right? So the Chinese are being pretty assertive on this front. But I think more interestingly, our traditional allies are being more assertive on this front. You see the Japanese being pretty assertive. You see Macron and the French sort of trying to step in and assert themselves as guardians of certain ideas in terms of the global liberal order. What's interesting here is, in some sense, I think that's what Trump was asking for. Right. It's a question of, hey, step up, do your part. We need to pull back a little bit. The problem is, first of all, I don't think we really did need to pull back. I think we had the material capabilities to continue to lead globally. And, you know, there is this sort of buyer's remorse, I think, as we sort of among the American people, as we see other countries step into that role, it raises questions like the ones you're raising here. Right. Why is the U.S. Kind of being pulled out of this global leadership position? So in that sense, I think it's hurt us, and it's led to a lot of questions.
Our guest today, Professor Philip Potter from University Department of Politics. We are talking about foreign policy from President Trump's leadership and the Trump White House. Professor Potter, we were talking about the doctrine, foreign policy. You said you made mention of how when President Trump took over and sort of putting other countries back on their heels, So let me mention a few things here and get your thoughts on how that puts the USA image, the imagery put forth into other countries. So at the NATO meetings, President Trump seemingly pushed by Montenegro's President Markovic to get to the front for pictures. Is that image, what is the image to other world leaders? Is that powerful? Or is he a butthead? When you go to the G7 leadership and others walk through Sicily while President Trump rides in a golf cart, is that a president being carried by his, you know, sort of being carried on his throne? Or is that someone who's too weak to walk with others? And he has his alpha male handshakes for some, except is it with Germany's leader, Angela? And is it Angela? I never pronounce that properly. With Merkel. But I don't believe he shook her hand at all. Is that correct? So what is the image that other leaders have of him and other countries as a whole have of him?
I think it's mixed, right? I mean, there's a lot of countries out there. There are a lot of cultures. There are a lot of feelings of.
How about the important ones? I don't want to diminish other countries, but there are some that in the world are nearer at the top in terms of determination as to where the globe goes, in terms of. Gosh, and I realize I'm leading myself down a difficult path here. But
maybe we can just say G20 countries,
yes,
in order to bail you out of
take over this path and save me from my own problems.
There are different groups even in there though, and this is where I think it matters. So Trump had some pretty successful early bilateral meetings with the Chinese, with the Japanese, a couple of other partners that actually. By external accounts, went relatively well, right? The other parties walked out of those and said, okay, this is somebody who we can come to an understanding with. I don't know how he shook their hands, right? Again, he seems to do a little bit better in a bilateral setting where the cameras are off, right? Where he's really, we've had these things that have become sort of internet viral clips of awkward handshakes and walking past people and through people and golf carts and all these sorts of things. These have been concentrated among our sort of European allies, right? Big, important European countries, big summit meetings, these sorts of things. And so clearly he's not a natural diplomat. Right, he doesn't behave in a way that is naturally diplomatic. He comes across certainly in the way these film clips come, as a little bit boorish, perhaps. My instinct is to be a little bit cautious about this, right? And what I'm getting at here is that I'm not sure how this is playing to both his constituency and his conception of how he should be acting in the world. I think this might be relatively intentional. Okay. And to
intentional,
right? And to the extent that sort of in the painting of this from kind of that side of the spectrum might put it, that these sort of effete European liberals want to look down their noses at him, I'm not sure that that's really detrimental to certain domestic goals and certain domestic audiences, right? And so I think Angela Merkel struggles with him because her instinct is to sort of chide him, right? You're stepping out of line and you're doing unacceptable things and you are breaking basic norms of the international system. And I'm not going to reward you for that, right? I'm going to essentially treat you as a child. Frankly, I think in certain cases he is stepping out of line and she's not incorrect. I'm not sure that it's a diplomatically effective thing to do. And you can sort of see that in the recent French visit where effectively Macron, by being willing to say, actually, I'm going to ignore that, right? I'm just going to push that aside. I'm going to give this person what they want. he effectively sort of stepped into Germany's place, at least for a minute, in terms of the face of Europe, right, as a global economic and as a global power. Right, that's traditionally Germany's role. France has been used to be a partner in that, but has been out of the running for quite a while. But by making that diplomatic move, Macron was able to assert himself, right, and reclaim that mantle. And so, in general, while I do think it hurts public opinion about the United States inside of these countries, I'm not sure that it hurts Trump's peculiar objectives in terms of, you know, blazing past people and giving, you know, vice grip handshakes and all these sorts of things.
21 minutes after the hour, our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics, talking about foreign policy in the Trump administration. Hang tight. And back here on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, I'm Rick Moore, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about foreign policy in the Trump White House with our guest, Professor Philip Potter, Director of National Security Policy Center from UVA's Department of Politics. Standing in the free world. So it sounds like that in your belief that our standing in the free world has not changed too much, and the little that it has changed is really not that tremendously important.
Well, so I think that's roughly right, although I want to kind of, you know, I'm a professor, I caveat everything. But the, you know, the concern that I have with that is that I think, so for now, I think we're okay, right? I think there's a little bit of shock in the international system because the U.S. really has been for certain generations, we've been basically a consistent rock in terms of foreign policy, right? The consistency in foreign policy, one president to the next, regardless of party, has been really impressive, frankly. This is different. So in that sense, you know, the recognition that actually the U.S.'s foreign policy can become a product of its domestic policy and its domestic divisions, I think, is surprising to the world and something that they've taken note of. It's something that's going on elsewhere. Certainly, you could tell a very similar story about the UK and Brexit, right? So this is a global phenomenon, a sort of populist phenomenon. But the U.S. is obviously the most prominent case of this. So right now, I think we can get it back. But I think it's important that the administration kind of steady itself a little bit. And maybe we're seeing some signs of that with the recent French visit. Went a lot better than the previous ones.
Well, I want to get into the French visit at some point, too. Sure. But let's talk about a specific country or two for foreign policy. So let's start with North Korea.
Okay.
Doing my homework, I didn't know this until doing my homework in preparation for your show. In early June, the White House declared North Korea the number one U.S. threat. Correct information?
I believe that's right.
Because at some point when you're doing your homework these days with all the internet articles, even the Trump administration would say, Washington Post, New York Times, can't believe what they write. So just because you read it in Politico or The Hill or something else doesn't mean that it's true. But the North Korea is now the number one threat to the United States over Russia, over China, depending on, you might say that Russia might be the number one U.S. threat for cyber issues, or China might be over what's the phrase for copyright infringement. But for everything, the Trump administration has now claimed North Korea the number one threat, placing it ahead of Russia.
You know, I don't know the context for that statement that they said it was the number one threat. I would say that, you know, often these sorts of things are political, right? And particularly, I don't mean sort of partisan. I also mean in terms of sort of signaling to an adversary that, hey, we're very serious about the situation right now, right? And not just to North Korea, but also to China and other parties to the situation that, you know, our focus is here and therefore we're taking this very seriously. You know, on some deeper level, you know, obviously North Korea is not the number one threat to the United States. North Korea cannot destroy the United States. They can't wipe the United States off the map.
They say they're going to turn us to ash.
Well, they don't have the weapons to do it
yet. And they just launched an ICBM that went, I don't know how far, 1,500 meters?
Certainly, quite a lot further than that.
In April, they couldn't even, up until April, they couldn't even get one off the launch pad.
We had not seen that ICBM before, right? And, you know, there's a certain amount of concern that that ICBM had some hallmarks of some early Russian technology.
But from somewhere, they now have nuclear weaponry that can actually go into the Pacific Ocean.
So to be clear, they have nuclear weapons, right? They have bombs, and they have missiles. They don't have a demonstrated capability to miniaturize those weapons, put them on those missiles, and deliver them to targets in the U.S., right? But the point is, when you're thinking about the threat of North Korea, it's not where they are now that matters. It's where they're going that matters.
So certainly,
more than anyone else we're dealing with right now, they have demonstrated a clear interest in developing that capability, the capability to deliver a nuclear weapon to a major U.S. city.
So what is and has been the Trump administration foreign policy to work with or against the country that they have labeled the number one U.S. threat?
So the policy, as clearly as I think it can be read, is that, you know, we were going to lean on China to lean on North Korea, which is a policy that others have thought of, right? So this is not a Trump administration flight of fancy. This has long been thought to be the point of leverage. You know, a lot of people in the foreign policy sphere think that it might be overplayed a little bit, the extent to which the Chinese really have this capability, and certainly the extent to which the Chinese have any interest in doing it, any willingness to do it, is up in the air. And so this is, I think, part of saying, hey, this is the number one issue. We're going to put some sanctions on some banking entities. We're going to do some things to indicate to China that we're getting real about this. It's not worked, right? And I think the key thing to think about with North Korea is we have this real tendency to talk about them like they're crazy, right? And sort of make fun of the leader's haircuts and the funny marches in Pyongyang and sort of say, okay, these guys are nuts.
Right. Their whole country is poor, right? The whole country is poor. They don't have anything. I mean, they're listed as the poorest, most unsuccessful country in the world.
But North Korean analysts don't think North Korea is nuts, right? They think the North Korean regime is highly rational. And if you think about this from the perspective of sort of who's in control and what their interests are, I tend to agree with them, right? I tend to think that, you know, when you look at this as a regime, it's a very small group of people. What they care about, and, you know, they have a pretty good standard of living. They're doing pretty well for themselves. They care about maintaining their grip on power. And if they lose their grip on power, they almost certainly die. And this is part of the problem with, you know, some U.S. policies that long preceded this, right? So I think the North Koreans look over their shoulders at a place like Libya and say that Gaddafi made the wrong move, right? He gave up his weapons program. He got scared after, you know, the U.S. went into, labeled out the axis of evil and went into Iraq and all these sorts of things and went away from a nuclear weapons program. He ended up dead, right? They look at that and they say, you know, it's the one thing that can guarantee our survival, the one thing that can make sure that the U.S. never comes for us and no one messes with us, nuclear weapons, right? And so this kind of moves us into a conversation about, is there really anything you can do with an actor that's that serious about getting those weapons and has that good a reason to do it? Do you try to stop them at that point? Or do you try to do what we've always done with nuclear weapons, which is deter their use, right? It's not obvious to me that we can't deter North Korea. I think that's a possibility. And more to the point, it's not obvious to me that we have any other viable policy option. I think that's essentially our only choice on the table. And I go one step further and say that I think most people in the Trump administration and the U.S. foreign policy establishment tacitly agree. We still have the families of our U.S. troops are still in South Korea, right? We're clearly not getting ready to, you know, attack or decapitate this regime. Seoul is within artillery range of the North Korean regime. There's no play here. And I think that's the fundamental problem. So there was some hope that the Chinese could do this for us. I think kind of reality intervened and we are where we are. And unfortunately, I think for people who are thinking that there's going to be a quick solution, a muscular response, I don't think that's right. If I had to put money on it, I'd say that we'd be looking at a nuclear armed North Korea pretty soon.
This is WPVC 94.7 Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics. We are talking about President Trump and the White House foreign policy. One of the comments that has been made, because this is the progressive voice of Charlottesville, is that President Trump doesn't have a foreign policy. Comments?
You know, I personally think that's probably right. I would say that, you know, quite a few U.S. presidents haven't really had a coherent foreign policy early on in their administration, or frankly, often late in their administration. When they have had a coherent foreign policy, you know, neocons came in with Bush, and I think that there was a little bit more coherence there. Not sure that the, you know, your audience at the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville love how that turned out. So it's not necessarily having a sort of grand strategy in terms of what you want to be doing has its upsides and its downsides, right? In a lot of ways, I think the question is, does the Trump administration have a clear foreign policy response to some of these particular concerns? All right. So North Korea, for example, I don't really think that that was a very well thought out policy move that they employed, first saying, you know, by Twitter that with regard to an ICBM, hey, it's not going to happen, right? Well, you know, it did happen, and then what, right? And so, just like I think Obama messed up with regard to declaring a red line in Syria, same difference, right? You want to be careful about those sorts of statements. I think the idea that you could lean on China to solve this problem and that you would declare that as an explicit policy, that you make a lot of noise about that in a public way, again, I think that degrades our credibility, right? Because if you actually look at the recent history, that's been tried. There are experts who know a great deal about what's going on in terms of China's interests, in terms of North Korea's interests, who at the very least would have said, hey, proceed cautiously here. Right. This is not a silver bullet. This is not an easy fix. And so, again, you don't get out there and say that so loudly and so publicly and then have to turn around and again by Twitter say, oh, well, didn't work. You know, we had to try. Right. These are kind of fits and starts in policy that I think don't inspire a ton of confidence. And frankly, you know, I worry that the Chinese are getting, going to get a little bit emboldened by some of these moves, right? This sense that there's not a lot of fortitude on the U.S. side, that there is a lot of room to maneuver. And we have a lot of points of play with the Chinese with regard to Japan, with regard to Taiwan, South China Sea. I mean, there are a ton of issues. And this notion that we're disorganized in some sense is not a good one to send out there.
Is my memory that poor? Isn't the new or didn't the new South Korean president say that there was going to be an attempt to work with North Korea?
That's right. The new president is much more in this sort of sunshine policy tradition. This is something that South Korean politics has sort of waffled back and forth on for quite a while. Leaders come in who are relatively hardline on North Korea. Leaders come in who say, well, We're gonna try trade and reapproachment and all these sorts of things. We're currently in an administration in South Korea that is, by disposition, a little bit friendlier, right? They put a freeze on the THAAD missile batteries that were being installed, again, sort of as part of that idea. North Korean behavior in the interim has, I think, put a bit of a chill on that.
And by that you mean missile launching?
Exactly.
Again, our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, National Security Policy Center Director. Professor Potter, How about those who are in the Trump administration as those who are working for President Trump? I don't know what the proper term or phrase would be. The one that comes to my head is like foreign policy assistants. Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, and I'm sure that you know all the others, but are they doing a good job? Were they the, I mean, when he was brought forth as the person who was named for the job, many, I'll use the word many, people went, who? And what? Has he done a good job?
So I think the jury's out on Tillerson. I think Mattis and DOD has done, by most accounts, a pretty good job, pretty heroic job. The problem that all these folks have is the pace of the appointees beneath them, right? So they don't have, they're working with skeleton crews. That's coming from a variety of places, right? So the Senate's pretty bogged down, as you know, with healthcare and all these sorts of issues. The Trump administration's been pretty slow about putting forward nominations. And so we're getting to a point where we're historically far behind in terms of filling in the seats beneath people in the foreign policy staff. And it's true across the board, right? This is happening in the domestic policy bureaucracy as well. But I think that really limits the ability of these people to accomplish things, right? And it's particularly bad, in my view, for somebody like Tillerson, who's, you know, coming from Exxon, right? This is not, you know, Mattis is a career military man. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to tap informal networks. He knows how to get things done inside the building. Tillerson doesn't, or at least I can't imagine why he would. This isn't a critique of him, but if you're going to bring in an outsider to do these types of jobs, it seems to me that you really need to make sure that you have the people immediately beneath them who are insiders,
right? You need good administrative assistants.
Yeah, I mean, and these people are not administrative assistants. I mean, I take your point. You're absolutely right. But I mean, these people are doing super important work, right? So these are very, very, very high up administration officials who just don't exist. And the idea that you would be able to execute policy seamlessly with, you know, frankly, just too few people to do it, it's not that reasonable. And I think that that's part of why we see some of this kind of chunkiness in policymaking, some of these gaffes that happen, these sorts of things. You know, you just don't have the teams in place that you need to have in place.
Before we leave North Korea, is there anything that is missing in our conversation?
No, I mean, so what I think the takeaway that I try to convey to people about, you know, at least my read on North Korea is that this is unfortunately something that we're going to be living with, right? And I think various administrations going way back to Clinton have at different points in time sort of come to this recognition that this is one of those kind of immovable mountains in foreign policy, right? People's interests are just set up in such a way that, you know, getting getting big movement on this is tough. And so I really think we want to start thinking about what that means and how we adapt to it and how we move past ideas that, hey, this is unacceptable, to one where we actually, you know, we don't have to publicly declare it, but where we're actually accepting it and thinking it through in a serious way, like, what are we going to do, right? What is the policy moving forward if this country moves into this space? And, you know, there's other countries that I think we never really properly did that with. I'm thinking particularly about sort of the Pakistan situation and their nuclear stockpile. You know, we just kind of let things proceed in a disorganized linear way. And I think, you know, maybe they probably are. There's a lot of smart foreign policy people out there, but I hope that people inside our diplomatic and military bureaucracies are thinking seriously about, you know, 2025 when North Korea has a deliverable weapon.
40 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA's Department of Politics, Director of the National Security Policy Center, author, War and Democratic Constraint. That book is now available. Hang tight. We'll be right back. And we're back in the loop here with Rick Moore, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. It's good to be back in the chair. Thank you so much to Dan for covering for me while we were gone. Just so you know, shows, get comfortable because you're going to want to be here every Sunday for the next month. Next week, Augusta County Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Alex Mador will be here talking about child sex abuse and trafficking. Week after that, John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute talking about constitutional rights. Then Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center, uranium mining and solar energy. And then the second Sunday in August, Albemarle County School Superintendent Dr. Pam Moran will be here. But nothing as good as the one you got in front of you. That's Professor Philip Potter as we talk about the Trump White House foreign policy and whether or not there is any. But we all know that there's foreign policy of some sort going on with Russia. And when we were exchanging emails, Professor Potter, one of the things that I gathered from your email was that it was sort of no matter which side of the table you're on, whether it was whether it was financial, whether it was out for the Clintons, whether it was truly smart politics, but there was something there about this idea of old enemies becoming new friends and where that stood in foreign policy. Was that right? Did I read that?
You mean old enemies with regard to Russia becoming new friends?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, what's kind of interesting in the background of this whole Russia discussion, you know, and I don't mean this in any way to absolve whatever has gone on. It's a little unclear, but, you know, increasingly it looks like, you know, certainly that the Russians were engaged in, you know, deeply problematic behavior in terms of interfering with our election. And increasingly, like, at least the fringes of the Trump administration were engaged with this, and that obviously is hugely problematic. But so, you know, let's take that and sort of bracket it for 1 second. What I think is interesting about this is the extent to which it has now kind of blown away what is a long-standing discussion on where the U.S. should be from a policy standpoint vis-a-vis Russia, right? Should we be thinking about reapproaching with Russia in order to rebalance against, frankly, against China, right? So, what is the prevailing threat in the international system that the U.S. should be oriented against? And, you know, the Obama administration, you know, several administrations have thought seriously about the idea of kind of pivoting to Asia, right? That this is where the future is. You know, Russia is, you know, the Russian GDP is $1.3 trillion or something like that, right?
Put that in.
We're at 19. China's at 11.
Okay, there you go.
Right.
Explain that. Put that in.
Yeah. So we're talking about a country that is, you know, struggling demographically. Right. This is a country where for years, life expectancies went down in a way that, you know, we're talking about this right now with opioids and this sort of crisis. It pales in comparison to what Russia dealt with. Right. This is a country that has, 140 something million people in it, I think. You know, U.S. has twice that. China's 1.3 billion. Again, you know, as you look at the sort of numbers on paper, the question is this the strategic competitor, or is it really, you know, Asia, China, that we need to be thinking about? And so there's long been this idea that, you know, the complications of dealing with somebody like Putin aside, that just, you know, from a geopolitical standpoint, we might want to figure out how to move Russia out of the column of sort of direct adversaries and into the column of, you know, people that we can deal with. I'm not saying they're going to become a close friend, but folks who we can deal with in order to reorient towards China, much in the same way that, you know, a generation ago, we leveraged the Sino-Soviet split in order to kind of bring China into the realm of countries that we could deal with so as to isolate the Soviet Union, right? This has shot that through for I don't know how long, right? This is not a conversation that's going to be able to take place inside of D.C. for quite a long time. Because it's become a partisan issue and because it's insinuated itself into our election. And, you know, some of this is Russia's own fault. But I think that that's an interesting point to sort of think about in terms of your question about, you know, adversaries becoming friends and friends becoming adversaries. I mean, we're now in a place where I think that Russia, you know, it's hard to imagine a democratic administration coming in and being anything but pretty hawkish on Russia, right? And it's hard to imagine the Trump administration doing anything that is, you know, really positive in this direction in terms of, you know, sanctions or something like that, because they're so in a box with regard to this election issue. And so, you know, whether it's the right move or not, it, I think, is off the table from a foreign policy standpoint.
Right. We have seemingly awakened all of our older senators and brought back the Cold War to say, wait, these are our, you know, there is Darth Vader, and we should not be talking to him.
Yep. I mean, yeah, we'll see how John McCain's, I think, you know, in Arizona right now trying to be awakened. But there's, you know, some of these older senators have a separate set of issues. My concern is sort of exactly that, the one that you're laying out, which is, you know, we're having trouble having a nuanced foreign policy conversation because of the extent to which it's getting tinged with partisanship, right? And, you know, some of this, again, it's not that it's not reasonable. I understand why this is happening, and it's happening for specific reasons. I mean, this a foreign power appears to have interfered in our domestic politics. So that's not just us that's causing that to happen. But you know, we used to benefit substantially from the fact that the foreign policy makers in D.C. were, frankly, less partisan, more tightly integrated across administrations, more cohesive in their worldview than folks who are arguing about education, healthcare, domestic policy, right? And that helped, you know, going back to my prior point about consistency in U.S. foreign policy, that's part of the reason we had that consistency, is that there was this, you know, established group of people who were informed by considerable expertise, who would often bleed over from one administration to the next, even if those administrations were of different parties. We're losing that. And I think that's a tragic thing to lose as a country. And frankly, it's dangerous, right? So I don't really have a prescription for how to solve it. And I think this Russia situation has exacerbated it in ways that even make high-minded ideas about solving it really hard, because they really are integrated with one another, the domestic and the foreign policy side of things. But I think it's something to watch, and I think it's something that we should be paying attention to as citizens.
11:49 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. WPVC 94.7. So you mentioned how the Russian issue with foreign policy really plays into China. So let's talk about that for a minute. And we also mentioned China when talking about North Korea. So obviously the foreign policy with China they are the largest country. Do they have largest country in the world in terms of population? Largest country in the world in terms of economics as well? Or is
the
USA still?
Not yet.
How far away?
In terms of total economic size,
GDP?
It's comparable, right? It's the growth rates that people worry a lot about, right? And so where China will end up. Certainly, if you kind of extrapolate out GDP per capita for the United States to a population like China's, it's a tremendous number, right? Probably not a number that's actually achievable, but it's a huge number. And so a lot of it is in terms of economic potential. But you know, China is the U.S.'s competitor, right? This is the country that we should be paying attention to, right? This is the one that is demographically, the serious 800-pound gorilla in the room.
But when we were talking about Russia a moment ago, at times over the past, I guess if we go back to the Cold War, we're talking 60 years, where it was actually two countries fighting one another at times. I mean, we had nuclear weapons lined up against one another. With China, we seem to be more about who's winning the economic battle.
Right.
Or, you know, who's buying more and who can do so for less. Are we... Have we reached the stage where it's a mean fight, or is it still just a friendly game about whose elbow is in front of the other person?
Yeah, I mean, so more the latter, I'd say, although I don't know how friendly it always is. You know, we have various ways of describing this, and the Chinese have various ways of describing this. And strategic competitors, the Chinese used to talk a lot about sort of peaceful rise, the idea that they could get bigger and grow without it necessarily turning into... you know, a military competition or a military fight. You know, this gets harder and harder as time goes on, right? And it's something that we manage very carefully on the foreign policy side of things. I don't think it's clear in any way that we necessarily need to get into a kind of new Cold War with the Chinese, right? So when I talk about sort of reorienting towards Asia and reorienting towards China, I'm talking about sort of a full spectrum economic, military, story, right? It's not that I think you know, they're the new Soviet Union. It is a different kind of relationship. It's a much more interdependent relationship in terms of trading relations, in terms of economic relations, in terms of investment. We never had that with the Soviet Union, right? That matters, right? They hold our debt. We trade with them. It's a different kind of scenario. But nonetheless, it is one that needs to be carefully managed. And that's kind of the key point. And as the bigger China gets and the bigger its vision of its proper place in the world grows. And again, you know, there's some legitimacy to that, but this notion that they should control their immediate periphery, right? They look at the South China Sea, and if you talk to Chinese foreign policymakers about this, they talk about our Monroe Doctrine, right? The idea that, like, this is just none of your business. Get out of here, right? And that's a lot of, that causes a lot of tension, right? We have allies in that region. We have interests in that region. Those are strategic shipping lanes. There's a bunch of reasons why it's not easy for us just to cede that. And so we need to pretty carefully manage that transition and that process in order to make sure that U.S. interests are taken care of.
Are relationships with China better, same, worse than with the previous administration?
The reason I'm hesitating there is that, you know, we have such a complex set of relationships with China, right? And this is partially, again, what makes it so different from the Cold War and the Soviet relationship. We're interacting with China on 1,000 dimensions every single day.
Okay, well, right? Then is it better or worse than it was at the start of the Trump administration? Since President Trump took over, has it gotten better or has it declined?
I think it's gotten a little worse. At the very top level, right? So I think very early on, there was a pretty cozy meeting between the Trump administration and the Chinese, Xi Jinping, at Mar-a-Lago. And there was a sense, I think, that this was a relationship that we could work with, right? Since then, I think the unpredictability of U.S. foreign policy, the North Korea situation, and some of the talk about trade have all kind of put a chill on that. I don't think it's a deep chill. I just think, you know, a lot of this is about expectations. I think there was initially sort of a, oh, wow, this is maybe a good thing. Maybe this is something we can work with on both sides of the equation. And then it subsequently has kind of moved back into a place which is, frankly, a little more realistic, which is this is a complex relationship, and there are a lot of points of potential tension here.
Just a few minutes left. It's 56 after the hour. Our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics, Director of the National Security Policy Center. We are talking about the Trump White House foreign policy. And we just went to Paris. Many people would say that the show that was put on was specifically for President Trump to sort of get him excited, to push his buttons. Do you think that that was done to change or to enhance President Trump's foreign policy decisions the way that Europe might want them to get done?
So, yes and no. That event was already going to happen, right?
The Bastille Day,
you know, the
military
big,
parade.
The military parade, the big pomp and circumstance, that was all going to happen, right? What wasn't going to happen was Trump wasn't going to be there, right? And then my understanding is that Macron sort of brought it up, and Trump said, hey, that sounds kind of fun, and there we go, right? There's a bilateral meeting there. I think that that indicates a couple things, right? So first of all, U.S. presidents, you know, people kind of in the media painted this as this surprising situation that he was going abroad, and oh, it's a whim, and he likes military stuff. Actually, it's a pretty time-honored tradition that when things are not going well at home domestically with domestic policy, U.S. presidents try to go abroad, right? So they do these kind of unscheduled trips. And so you can sort of see it as an indication of a stalled domestic agenda. And as I said before, I think it was a pretty savvy move on Macron's part to provide Trump with this venue and this, you know, being allowed to sort of look decent, frankly, in a foreign policy setting because it elevated Macron, right? So I don't know that it's going to move the needle on U.S. policy with regard to Europe. People have talked about this as the entry point for the U.S. getting back into the climate agreement. I don't really see that. But I do think that it certainly helped the French.
But in what way does it help Trump foreign policy? You don't think that it makes any changes. It's just a good, fun day.
I think that that's right, although I wouldn't say that that's totally trivial, right? So he, you know, won a couple news cycles, right? Those were a couple of days where Trump looked pretty good out there.
A news cycle when he makes sort of a sleazy comment to Macron's wife.
Maybe in a relative sense, won a news cycle compared to how some of the previous ones had gone. There was some good imagery out of it, changed the dialogue a little bit. We spent 48 hours not talking about Russia as much. The point being that foreign trips for presidents, they're small wins. They're just meant to sort of wipe the deck clean, and then maybe you can rebuild from there. And so I think this is partially why people were, you know, in the Trump administration were so disappointed by the prior trip, because frankly, on the plane ride home, they were already getting hammered on Russia. And so there we are.
Will you come back for another conversation in the future?
Anytime.
Thank you very much. Our guest today, Professor Philip Potter, UVA Department of Politics, Director of National Security Policy Center. Thanks very much. Listen again next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.